Welcome everyone to today's programming languages. If you think back on last Wednesday, we were talking about the effects that modern hardware has on our machine model and the way that we are thinking of what actually happens in sequence on a machine. And we were explicitly talking about the fact that stores are not performed immediately but are buffered, and also invalidation messages are not carried out immediately but instead are buffered, so that with just the standard MAISY protocol that we have on modern cache architectures, just that kind of protocol is not sufficient to ensure sequential consistency. So what we have as a programmer or compiler, we have to make if you want to make sure that a system behaves sequentially correct, then we need to use other means than we have before, particularly write barriers and read barriers. So let's have a look at how a concrete problem, a concrete algorithm is affected by these effects that we have seen. And what I've chosen as an example for that is the Decker algorithm. No, not that. This one. Does anyone here know the Decker algorithm already? Okay. So everybody is eagerly anticipating what's coming now. The Decker algorithm is an algorithm to achieve areas of mutual exclusion for two processes. And if I say two, I mean exactly two processes. So mutual exclusion for two processes is the goal, and it does so by performing busy waiting. Nevertheless, it achieves mutual exclusion, at least that's its goal. What are the components for that algorithm? We have a few common variables. So there's two flags and a turn counter. The flags have Boolean value and the turn counter has numerical value, but might also be a Boolean value because we only have two processes. And the piece of code that is responsible for our mutual exclusion is actually over here. And, well, that's the version for one of the two processes, and it'll get duplicated for the other process. The only thing that's changed in there will be the parts where we have the process ID. So the numeric parts over here, those are the ones that will be exactly the other one. So if we have a look at process one, we'll see that the algorithm only differs in the process number of itself and the process number of its peer. So these are just swapped around. So what does that do? It looks a little bit complicated with all these nested whiles and ifs and all that. So let's have a look in detail at the components of these of this algorithm. We have the two kinds of variables. There's the flags. Each of the processes owns conceptually one of these flags. And what the process can do is it flags that it wants to enter the critical section. So by setting one of the flags to true, so setting flag I to true, process PI flags that it wants to enter into the critical section. The critical section is located where just the comment is. It needs to be replaced with the code that needs to be executed in this critical section. So, naturally, what the two processes start with would be that they would flag that they want to enter the critical section. Yes, please?
What would be this critical section, something like a memory read or write?
The critical section is one of the means to ensure that only one process at a time is executing that specific particular code. So this would be something where you don't want to have anyone else interfering with you or with the same resources. You would probably use certain resources that can exclusively used one person at a time for that. For example, you would something memory, some I/O related stuff. If you're interacting with a printer or something, you don't want another print job to put out something in between. So things that you need to keep safe from an interruption. Yeah. So probably you could also try to do some kind of transaction in there where you want to touch several locations that have something in common, need to keep some kind of invariant intact or something. For that, you would need such a critical section. Anyway, if you, as a process P0, you flag for entering the critical section. If everything goes completely fine, then the other process has not flagged that it wants to enter. So if the condition in the while loop here is actually false, so flag for process 1 would be false, then everything is fine. Then it's just one process who wants to enter. Then the control is actually leading you directly here because it won't enter the while loop. So we can directly perform our critical section. So let's have a look at what happens if our peer, process 1, also wants to enter. Then, in this case, if both want to enter, one needs to have the privilege to go on, and the other one needs to wait. So for that, we have the other memory location, which is the turn variable, turn counter. And in case that it's our turn, it would read turn is 0. In that case, we don't need to care what the body of the if statement actually is. And again, we can just proceed to the critical section. If it's our turn, we can do so. But in case that it's not our turn, we need to do something different. In that case, we would just undo our flag and wait for the turn variable to switch its value. Yes, please.
How do we ensure the variable turn is not being overwritten by the other process? Why is this being read?
Well, it might be. But we will return to that point at some point because we're in a loop. So there might be something happening in between, but at some point we will return to that point. Okay, so in case that it's not our turn, what we do is we flag false for a moment and then wait for... No? Why it's not happening? Wait for the turn signal. And if it is 0 again, so our own process number, what we'll do is we will renew our flag to point out that we want to enter. And in this case, we need to reevaluate the whole thing. In a case that we had to wait in between, meanwhile, the turn variable will probably be, well, not probably, but will for sure have switched to the other value because we have been waiting for that during our busy wait. And in this case, we will have the turn variable in, no, the turn variable point to our own process ID, and then we will enter. So in case that we had to wait, we have done so during this loop of busy waiting, and then we reevaluate the whole loop. Okay, so that's how we treat these signal variables. In the end, we will enter the critical section at some point. So we can do the things we want to do exclusively without the other process interfering. And now, when we leave the whole thing, we will have to make sure that the other process also is able to enter the critical section at some point. So what we do is we set the turn to the other process, and then just undo our flagging. So that's what the idea behind Decker is. Is there any questions about that? I think it needs a little bit time to parse the whole thing and to imagine the other process next to this one.
Does it scale automatically to more than two processes?
Well, it's just made for two in these cases. So it only works in this binary notion because you have these two that give each other priority after they have finished, and you need a lot more sophisticated scheduling if you want to have more than two processes involved.
Well, if the best one, it would work.
Well, we probably would also have to change the way that. Yeah, because we also have to check whether there are conflicts in the flagging. So it's probably a little bit more than that, but I'm sure that there's extended versions of the Decker algorithm out there. However, I'm not sure how far they still resemble the the initial one. So, yeah. But the principal idea behind that is probably similar, I would assume. I haven't checked. But for our purposes, it's already enough to have two peers, because what we want to do is we want to check how the whole system behaves when we port it to an environment where sequential consistency is not kept automatically, and want to see how that affects correctness.
Short question. Is it possible that there are two braces missing for the while loop?
Well, that's
not
necessary, but you could put them there.
If you only have one line behind it assumes automatically.
Ah, okay.
You can do it with if statements and everything.
Yeah. So thinking back to the program languages part with the, where you have grammars and all that, there's certain things like statements, and the statement is something which is just, this is one statement, you can connect it to one. Okay, so anyway, I can also give you a short view on both of them in parallel, if it helps. So it's probably these two. Anyone who blocks continuing? Is there a veto? Okay. You're still thinking.
Finished.
It's finished? Okay. Good. So That's what you would need that algorithm for. Well, you can apply it, for example, when you want to perform chains of computations where you want to give the result of the first computation to the next one to continue processing. So one application for that would be, for example, to have several map and reduce functions implemented. So if you have a chain or sequence of these processing functions, you could communicate between them with the help of such a thing in the form of some kind of buffer. And in this case, you would have two peers that would have to communicate with each other via a common thing, and you would need to make sure that the state that the buffer is either empty or filled, you would have to communicate that state between these two peers. And yeah, you could do so by communicating these state changes. If you try to keep these state changes apart with these with the Decker algorithm by kind of keeping the critical sections where you work on the state up separate from each other. Anyway, I'm not so sure that you really needed an example for that, so let's just skip that. I think you can imagine places where you need critical sections, so I think I'll remove these things from the slide. So what happens if you do the Decker's algorithm on a system where you don't have sequential consistency? Well, the thing is that this algorithm absolutely relies on that the changes that you do on these variables are visible to the other process as soon as you do them. If you do not, you can have weird behavior in your critical section because you might end up with both of them accessing that part, although you have done quite a lot of code to prevent these critical sections from overlapping. So there's a problem here for Decker's algorithm, because it actually requires to a sequentially consistent machine model. So in order to use this algorithm on modern hardware, what you need to do, well, you will need to insert memory barriers at the right positions. So how would the whole system look like? Well, there's store fences or write barriers, and the other part is the read barriers or the load fences, depending on how you call that. So where you have where do you have to apply the one or the other? Can you remember from last time? That's the version where you can't make any mistakes, but you also keep the system from using liberties to parallelize your code. But in principle, you're right. But the strategy would be to minimize the applications of these fences. So the idea would be to use store fences whenever you have written to a common variable, as well as load fences before you load from common variables. So for our example, that would incorporate to the use of store fences after you've written. So there is a store fence, and you've written here and here, as well as those two. then there's fractions where you do loads. So you read from common variables here. And there's for the friends of special grammar oddities, there's an application for the comma operator. I'm not sure whether you've seen something like that. Well, that's an application for that if you need to prepend, for example, a fence instruction at a certain statement. You can do so by applying the comma operator where you can daisy chain statements to each other.
Is that different? Can you do it many times as you want?
Sorry?
Can you do the comma as many times as you want?
Yes.
Yeah. It's just a binary operator.
Return result is the last. Okay.
Yeah, so the return value needs to be specified, and that's exactly the last one. Yeah. So there's a read instruction. Here's a read instruction. Here, and you see that's why these comma expressions are so handy, because in each of the places where we needed to use these kind of expressions, we didn't have room for a second assignment, or a second statement. So the play in these braces in if statements or loops, you are only allowed to use an expression. So you're depending on that you can chain these expressions with the comma operator. Okay, so I think these are all the read accesses. So we insert the load and the write barriers. And yeah, if it happens that two of these types are coming one after each other. For example, there's one situation here. We have store fences as the last statements before you enter the evaluation of the re-evaluation of the loop condition, where you do a load fence. Then you could, in principle, also resort to a general memory fence, where you do load barriers and write barriers at the same time. So this is mFence instruction. Actually, it turns out that for at least the implementation that I have seen, there was no disambiguation between load and store fences, so we had to resort to the mFence in any way, but that is a little bit architecture dependent, so you have to check your documentation, what is actually offered by your system. So if there's no disambiguation between these two, you just have to put fence at every place where it's needed. Okay. So, in summary, memory barriers are the kind of lowest level of synchronization. It's just making sure that your changes are communicated to your peer or communicated from someone else. Where would you apply them? Well, in case that you encode something like several processes that together implement some kind of state machine or automaton, where you have to communicate the internal state somehow between the different processes. So for these kind of things, you need to exactly know what the changes that the other peers did actually are. So for these, they are particularly useful, and one of the other properties that these special means have is that they are means of communication which actually don't block. So you can never run into something like a deadlock situation or something, because these are instructions that will eventually, at some point, receive the messages that they are actually waiting for. They just rely on some buffer to be emptied or some message to be delivered at some point. So as long as these things happen, your process will run on. And since you cannot really influence that with your program flow, that's something that's not able to create a deadlock or something. When would you actually use that? Well, a lot of these things are quite near to the machine. So in cases where you do embedded or operating systems, then you would probably resort to that kind of synchronization. Or if you want to have special purpose constructs like these specialized buffer implementations, where you would also like to do I would also want to have more control over workload distribution or something. With these kinds of things, you would probably resort to that kind of synchronization, if it is even offered to you by your environment. If you use some kind of higher level virtual machines, these types of machines might not even offer you control over this kind of behavior. But if you resort to languages that are more down to the machine, to the bare metal, then you will probably have the opportunity to apply these types of synchronization things. Whether are they not appropriate? Well, in most of the cases, you don't actually want to think about low-level effects like the ones that you have seen where an invalidation of a cache line is stalled, or the write to your cache line is actually not performed right now, but in some future timestamp. Then, well, in these cases, there are constructs that make actually use of these means without exposing you to the thoughts that are around sequential correctness and all that. In particular, there would be something like locks, and with these means, you would probably be quicker, and it would probably be easier for you to do that. Nevertheless, it's kind of still important to know about the changes in machine model that have happened in the last years, especially when you reconsider such ideas as using unprotected variable exchanges. And yeah, so that's nice to know in any way. So also, if you see that you have to use too many fences in your code, you will probably run into bottlenecks of where the store and invalidate buffers are actually having a large influence on the performance of your system. You probably need to reconsider or rethink about the algorithm that you're actually using there. Okay. How do compilers treat these kinds of properties? Well, they're mostly up to the programmer. You can resort to things like the volatile attribute for certain variables, so that's something that you can use, and this will be in some versions of your compiler. This is something that helps by making the compiler automatically insert the particular synchronization primitives for you. However, it's not guaranteed that it does that in an optimal way, so that might slow you down quite a lot if you use volatile too much and have too much communication on these variables. What's there in the newest standards for your favorite compiler, then there's the possibility to use atomic variables. Apart from a few other properties, those will also guarantee sequential consistency by inserting kind of memory barriers. And, well, there's also systems that are on a higher level, like this Java or Go or C Sharp or something, where the runtime system actually has documents where it describes the model that it is establishing for you. So, yeah, in these systems you have to read the documentation and actually understand what that means for that. So that's important to know about these, the terms that are used there. You're already in. Okay. Well, the volatile is also giving the compiler hints about other optimization strategies where it would, if it would not use that volatile, the compiler would assume that the value would stay the same for that variable throughout sections where it doesn't touch the variable. So it can do things like value propagations, constant value propagations or something, so it would try to optimize if it sees the possibility. If you use volatile, then you can communicate to the compiler that that particular location does not stay the same. So in these cases, the compiler would refrain from assuming anything about that memory location. Atomic just says that each time that you access the thing, you will try to do so in one transaction.
So if we serialize all the process when they come into the right process.
Sorry?
When, like, let's say there's several threads using one server variable, and this is defined at atomic, then those processes will be serialized.
I would say so because it's atomic, yes.
Because I have something similar in CUDA.
I'm not so sure about CUDA. I've not looked into that. But probably if it uses the same words, then it will do something different. There are several examples for same wording, different behavior. But yeah, that's kind of traditional in programming languages. Anyway, we would have to check the manual for that. Good. So even more summary. That's probably for people at home to read the lecture slides anyway. What did we have for summaries? Well, we have talked about strict consistency and the notion of sequential consistency, and then also about introducing components to our system that weaken our consistency model step by step. So that's what so far about the consistency models. And we have illustrated consistency with these happened before relations and the process diagrams. We have talked about cache coherence protocols and the influence that store buffers, invalid buffers, and memory barriers have on these protocols. And we have seen the barriers in action in our synchronization algorithms. In this case, we have picked the Dekker's algorithm, and you have seen how inserting fences would actually work. So, yeah, there's a small outlook on recent developments in multi-core systems, or in this case, many-core systems, as the number of cores increases. There's limits for what our symmetric multiprocessing actually can achieve. So this is about limits that come up when you try to scale these systems to very large numbers. Well, what we have seen in the previous slides were just two pairs of cores in these systems. So we modeled only two processes and according caches, And we've seen that there's already quite a lot of communication going on between those. So we have seen the happened before relations between just these two cores. And you have to imagine that if you scale up the number of communicating peers, then you will have quite a lot more usage of the communication means, which is a bus system in these architectures. So if you think back at what types of messages we had, there was, for example, the need for writing into a cache line at some point. For that, you issued a invalidation request message, and the other peers, which might also have a local copy of the variable values in shared state in their cache line, needed to acknowledge that invalidation thing. And that's something. If you scale up the number of cores in your system, then you also enlarge the number of acknowledgements that you need to receive throughout the system. And as that is a bus, and a bus is something that, well, in contrast to reality, can only be used by one, you will get a lot of bus contention there. So there's a lot of communication happening in these kind of systems. And the speed that you get by parallelizing your software is actually influenced quite severely by this cache contention. So you have to communicate between all these things. And the solution that's out there from high-performance computing is, they also had similar problems in the past, where they had to design bus systems for larger numbers of processes communicating with each other. And at some point, it just isn't possible anymore to scale up. So the solution was to go away from a common bus and implement direct connections from each of the communicating peers to each other. So there's direct lines between those, which are called, these point-to-point connections. These are faster than a bus because, of course, you can use them exclusively for communicating only between two peers. However, it's not so easy to achieve something like trying to form a consensus between all the communication partners on these kind of systems, because you don't have this concept of all the peers seeing one of these messages all at the same time. And there's protocols to achieve something like that, but they're quite expensive. So in principle, there's the system NUMA out there, which is for non-uniform memory access, which means that you don't have the concept of shared cache anymore between all these CPUs, but instead you will have a certain kind of expert cores that are actually really... that keep certain memory areas locally at their own at their own space, and if another core wants to access the same cache line, for example, it has to query for that cache line at the owner of that specific cache line and fetch it over these point-to-point connections, and only then they can access these things. So that's what these non-uniform memory access actually means. You have to keep a directory of which CPU is responsible for which cache line, and then you have to communicate with the owner of that cache line in order to access that cache line. There's also protocols for communicating about, on that, and they're, well, they're actually already out there in the wild. They're implemented on, for example, the Opteron processors. In these cases, they are realized on chip, on the CPU itself. And there's also Itanium architecture, for example, where there's also the chipset involved, where the memory or the cache controller is kind of externally managed by the chipset. So on these systems, you have cache coherency throughout your non-uniform memory. And yeah, but it needs a lot of communication. It's pretty pretty complicated, and you see it's not really standard. Itanium is something that has not really made it to the mainstream market. And well, yeah, and then there's also the Opteron systems, which are also only one of the possibilities that you have for your many-core system. There's also other ideas for managing the larger number of processor cores. For example, there's the idea of just patching your old MESI protocol in a way that it can cope with the large number of messages. So there's the MESI-F protocol, for example, where they introduce a new state for your cache line, which is this F state. F is for forward, which means it is a kind of privileged state for your cache line. And if in your local cache your line is marked as forward, then you are assumed to be the one responsible for answering requests for that cache line. So in case that someone wants to read from a certain cache line, then not all the other peers are all accessing the bus with the answer at the same time, but instead it's only the one who has the forward entry in its cache, and thus the amount of communication on the bus is greatly reduced. However, it's not a precise thing, this forward state, so there are situations where this can get lost and has to be re-established in some way. So, yeah, I thought it would not be that pretty that I would like to present it to you on the slides, but it's nice to know, and you can bing it if you like, or whatever you'd like to use. Anyway, if you do your NUMA systems, there's a lot of communication. That's something that we have seen or have heard about already. So there's these processors which have direct connections to each other, like that. And you have to query for the one who's responsible for a certain cache line to directly deal with that owner of your cache line to get access to that. So that's what NUMA systems are all about, but we don't want to look too much in detail about that, because it's actually not a widespread standard or something. So it's if you're more into high-performance systems and clusters, then you should probably have a look at the particular lectures for that. But for here, I think it's enough to bother you with MESI and with invalidated and store buffers and all that. That's already enough to give you an intuition about what actually has to happen if you want to synchronize several processes with each other. So is there still any question? Which one?
Use bus locally, the last sentence. Use bus locally, use point-to-point links locally.
What does that mean? There's kind of hierarchies between in these systems also, where you have cores sitting on one processor, for example, and several processors in there. So there's hierarchies between the cache. So locally, you would use the bus to communicate cache line changes, and in case the cache line is not kept locally at one of these cores, you would have to resort to these point-to-point links to go somewhere else and get to a cache line. But that's really complicated stuff, and yeah, I think a lot of these graphics accelerator architectures also have to deal with these kind of problems where we have these kind of different groups of cores that can communicate quite easily with each other, but then there's other groups where you have to go farther distances and have to use different means of thing. But I'm not a real expert on the graphics accelerator architecture, so yeah, these are these many core systems where I'm not so firm. Okay, good. So that's all for that topic. By the way, while I'm opening the next slides for the next tutorial session, I want to actually give you the chance to get a feel of how these effects of your cache protocol actually affect your code, and I want to do so in a practical experiments, and for that you would need to bring your laptop with you, and also please, while you're still while you still have the chance to do so overnight, please install a VirtualBox client on your machine, because I will at some point, probably for the next tutorial session, give you a virtual machine image where I have installed, or well, not me, but an assistant has installed a lot of software that comes in handy for the next tutorial sessions, and yeah, I want to have a kind of an environment where I don't have to make you download a lot of software in the beginning of each of the tutorial sessions. So that's why I want to give you one at one time one package which you can download and then use for your own amusement, and of course also for the tutorial exercises that we will do with each other. So next time we will try to experiment with the effects of our processors' caches. Is there anyone who uses still a single core machine as his or her laptop? Well, you're screwed. You won't see anything. But apart from you, is there? Yeah, you just don't need to come to the tutorial. No, of course, I'm sure there will be people giving you the chance to get a sneak peek on their screen. So, or you can even use my machine then. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, that's the plan for the next tutorial session. Also, as last time, we have not so many people coming to the tutorial session anymore. I think it's a good time to switch to the Thursday appointment. So I've counted, and I think that the 30 people that have shown up last time should also fit into the room that I have managed to get from the administration guys. So, yeah, we will, for the tutorial, we will meet tomorrow at, was it 12? I think it was 12 o'clock. In this building, in the second floor, seventh finger, room 14, that's one of the ones that you can access directly from the balconies.
So that is a computer.
Pardon me?
That is also a computer.
It doesn't have computers in there, but it has these the power connections. so you can get power for your laptops. And I think there also should be switches so that you don't need to rely on the famous Eduroam. Yeah. I also got to like this one quite a lot. Anyway, yeah, so that's why I would prefer to go to this special lab room, because I think there's not so many power connections to, distributed over there, is there? Well, I see one, two at least. Yeah, I think that's not good for doing practical typing, so let's go to the other room. Okay, anyway, what we're going to continue with today is other means of synchronization in concurrency, which will mean talking about atomic executions, locks, and monitors. So what you've seen so far is probably not making you jump from excitement. You've heard about sequential consistency and memory barriers. But there's, of course, a lot of more concepts out there to get your concurrent software correct. And you probably want to do more than just manage a state machine throughout several processes. You would probably want to exchange more complicated data with each other. So we need other means than just memory barriers. For example, one of the things that are actually something worthwhile thinking about is means to ensure that you can update certain memory areas in just one atomic execution. So what does that mean? That means that you, at some point, you decide that you want to make changes to your whole system, and what you want to do is that in one step, these changes are actually valid at some point. And this is fine for your with your barriers, as long as you only have one variable involved. But as soon as you involve several variables, then well, it's not so easy to get them executed at just the same, or conceptually the same, point of time. So, yeah, we need a more advanced concept of atomic executions. So, for our purposes now, what we are going to look at is concurrent programs that consist of two or several threads that share common resources. And well, you've already asked about things that need to be kept in one atomic execution. In most cases, you will have some locations in memory, or even thinking large scale, or pieces of memory, or probably memory mapped I/O or something, which you want to access exclusively. For example, a file handle or something, or some kind of memory address that's directly mapped to your most likable web camera or something. So something like that have to be accessed only exclusively. And for these resources, you would have to retain some kind of environment. For example, being able to access that thing exclusively is already one invariant, but you would also have more complicated invariants. For example, if you think for systems that want to perform whole transactions where you have to keep your balances in a certain state, when you do when you administer accounts in if you're an accountant somewhere, you need to put the right modifications to both sides of the equation. That's something for example where you need an invariant for. So an environment is something that might have several resources involved at some point. And as the building blocks for our programs are able to modify the memory locations only one by one, if you want to perform a certain transaction, you will at some point break the invariant, or at least do so while you do your update. But the concept would be that after you've done your after you've completed your transaction or your update, then the environment is valid once again. And in order to think about systems that only have valid invariants, you might want to protect your executions from being interrupted at some point. So, ideally we would want to have ways to mark sequences of operations as being atomic. But that's something which is quite hard to achieve. Has anyone heard about the TSM feature of recent processors from a major manufacturer? Well, there was in mainstream desktop processors there, or well, probably more the server process, but also in some types of desktop processors, there were already features introduced that would implement something called a hardware transactional memory, which would give you the chance to try to perform a sequence of operations as an atomic sequence. However, they failed in achieving this atomicity in a correct way, and they had to disable that feature via firmware update in a later version. So, it's really quite complicated to get that whole system right, and also has some kind of downsides that we will probably see when we talk about that. Anyway, is someone interested in something like these hardware transactional memories? Well, there's one of the projects that I wanted to offer you in order to get the great bonus would be to come up with a small software project that actually tries to make use of that hardware transactional memory. So if there's anyone up for that, he or she can just sign up and we can talk about what he or she should do for that. Anyway, in systems up to a certain point, there were no possibilities to make use of such atomic sequences. Instead, we had certain other means to achieve this transactions, and we will talk about them. So there's what we talk about is the techniques that are present for most platforms right now, and which you probably have seen already from a kind of user perspective so far. But now we want to delve into the internals of these types of constructs, and also talk about the common tasks that these solutions try to solve. So these are things that you can make use of in mainstream languages like this, these C-based languages, Java, C#, so even high-level virtual machine languages, and other imperative languages use these kinds of things. What we're going to see is the principle of these basic building blocks for that, which are these atomic executions. Then we are going to look at certain strategies how to make use of these things. There's the idea of these weight-free algorithms. There's the idea of lock-free algorithms, which I haven't on these learning outcomes, but nevertheless, still important. Then we're going to talk about the internals of different lock structures, which are these mutex, semaphores, and monitors. And we'll talk a little bit about deadlocks and what deadlocks actually are defined as and how to prevent them. I'm sure we won't get to see everything today, but let's just start with what atomic execution actually is meant to be. So computation forms an atomic execution. When? Well, if its effect can only be observed as a single transformation in the memory. So there's one certain point in time where it just makes a click and your new state is there. So if that is conceptually what all the others can observe on a system, then we have had an atomic execution. Well, that's something that we would expect from hardware to do in any way, but yeah, as we have seen, it's not as simple as that. There are several classes of atomic executions out there. There's the ideal ones, which are the weight-free ones, when atomic execution always succeeds and never blocks, which is something which we really could work quite well. Then there's the slightly weaker concept where we have lock-free algorithms. This is atomic executions, which also never block, but maybe they just don't succeed at some point. So yeah, we have to kind of wait for some chance to repeat our action in some way. Then there's the ones that you've probably seen quite a lot of times, which is these locked executions, where an atomic execution will definitely succeed, but may block the thread at some point. And then there's our futuristic version, which is these transactions, where an atomic execution may fail, and yeah, might be that there's a recovery at some point, but that depends on the actual implementation, and we'll see a little bit about that in future. Okay, what are the major differences between them? Well, they differ in the amount of data that you can access during the atomic executions. For example, this hardware transactional memory is something that was implemented in a way that you could only queue up your instructions that you wanted to perform during a transaction up to a certain length, which exceeded some kind of which didn't succeed some kind of code cache line. Well, anyway, that was the hardware transactional memory. So the amount of data or instructions that you can do in that atomic execution is kind of limited. And there's limitations in expressivity. So you have different things that you can achieve with your operations, and also there's differences in granularity. So with some things you can only do access very small portions of objects, with others you can do more. So we'll have a look on that. So let's start with the ones that are quite a joy to work with. So these are the ones that don't block and also succeed in all the time. These are the weight-free atomic executions. So what would you say? Which of these are actually atomic executions? Program one. Mixed results. So who thinks program one can, or is, but probably first, is program one can program one be atomic? Okay. So all the rest say it cannot be atomic. Okay, is it definitely atomic? Nobody. Okay. So definitely atomic is probably one answer which is quite naive in such a way, because you can always think of a realization of that program in hardware where it's actually not atomic, but the more intelligent question would be to ask for, can you achieve atomic execution with that one? And program one, probably. Program two? So you probably wouldn't think that program three can be realized in an atomic way at all. Well, in fact, by default, that's what we definitely got right there, is that none of them is by default weight-free. However, there can be ways to implement them in atomic executions, of course, depending on what your architecture offers you to do. And okay. So there are certain preconditions on what needs to be done in order to achieve atomicity on these types of programs. So in all the cases, this I, where we actually, well, I is the only thing that's meant to be a memory location. So in this case, the I is modified over here and modified over here. The other things are kind of core or processor locally. So the J and the TMP are considered to be registers. In any way, I must be in memory and declared, for example, as volatile in order to get all the synchronization that we had before. And yeah, the way to get them to be atomic would be to make use of a certain concept of hardware. The idea would be to absolutely make sure that nobody else can access that type that specific memory location. So the idea would be to lock. That's something that we should definitely do red, because that's something quite harsh or severe, to lock the cache or even the bus system for a specific address during the duration of an instruction. So that the idea would be that no other process can actually access that piece of the memory while you perform this operation, and also the cache line cannot be modified by something. So there's kind of optimizations to determine whether you need to actually lock the whole bus or whether it suffices to just lock certain regions in a certain cache level or even in the memory. Anyway, the general concept would be to really disallow the usage of a certain memory area via a certain instruction. So that is something that can be done in mainstream processors on the x86 architecture, for example, by using this lock prefix to your instruction of desire. So, for example, if you want to realize this incrementation from program one, you would do so in your machine code via an increment operation, and to make sure that this happens exclusively only with you accessing the memory location, you would have to do it by locking cache and bus for your address, and you can do so in x86 architectures with that lock prefix. That's something that you can put in front of a lot of these instructions, so you can also realize other programs like program 2, where you, what's that doing? Well, that's reading from a certain memory location and then adding a constant to that memory location. How would you realize that? Well, what you would do is you would move your increment to a register. Then in one transaction, you would do an xadd on the memory address with the constant from your register, and do that in a locked fashion. Are there any experts on x86 architecture around here? No assembler anymore for any one of you? So you're quite riddled by what this xadd actually does, like I am. I think it's for exchanging the value that has been in your first parameter to move that thing into your second parameter, but I would have liked to confirm that. So no experts here.
I would expect to literally just add the plus operation doesn't just move it. I'm adding whatever is in my address key into whatever was in register AX before. So that's AX plus address, the value of AX plus value of address key.
Actually, not quite sure because that's, of course. Once again, these are slides that I got from my predecessor, so that's why I'm a little bit confused here. In the end, we need to end up with the old value of our memory address for I in J. And I just don't see why that should come from EAX if it doesn't do some kind of transfers. Yeah, so you see the same. Yeah, I'm actually not quite sure. I would have expected someone at least knowing a little bit better. Yeah. You've checked?
Yeah, I have the instruction set manual. And it's just called exchange and add. Basically,
it adds and exchange. Yeah, the old value before you did the addition. So the X is actually something that alters the semantics of your add.
It's called
exchange and add. Okay, so I was, that's what I was actually kind of expecting, but not sure. But thanks. Okay, so exchange and add is something you should probably know, or I should have known. So the other thing is. Third program, which does, what does it do? It just switches values, seems like, So, it exchanges between I and J, so you can imagine that if you have an exchange and add, you probably also have something to just exchange values between parameters, so that's probably what the exchange does here. So, that thing is probably directly encoding that code, and you can also put a lock in front of that. Okay. So with this lock prefix, we could make these three programs be atomic. So that's already quite an achievement. Why is that? Well, without the lock, they may have these instructions may have interleavings with other stores from other processors, so they might have not been atomic in this case. With the lock, they are now. And with that, we can already achieve certain types of algorithms in a way that they run correctly on concurrent systems. So an example from a practical system. Yeah. If we want to manage heap memory and do so for a system that allows concurrent allocations of heap memory, for example, we might have situations like that where we have the heap as an array and we keep book of the first free entry of my or of our heap in our first free pointer. Then what we need to do to allocate memory is we need to provide an allocation method, which is this alloc probably, which gets the size. And the core principle that we need to do is we need to perform exactly the type of code that we had in our second program. For example, we have the, or in this case, we have first free, which we need to read out, as well as change with by a certain amount of an integer, for example, here. So we need to increase it with certain constant, which is this size here. And that's something if we want to allocate this memory concurrently from different processes, we need to make sure that that's something which happens in a consistent way. So we need to get the start address as the address that's which is then in the next assignment increased by the size that we wanted to get from our allocator, and we need that to be the next first free value in an atomic way, so that other processes that access our or that want to allocate heap will either have to be quicker than us, so that they can allocate the memory before us, and we can work on their new first free pointer, or they need to wait until we're finished doing so, so they can use our first free pointer. Without that, we would have overlapping heap addresses, and that's cause a lot of problems. So this pattern that we have seen there is something that we can really use in practice, and for that purpose we can just apply the means that we have seen. So we can just use this lock prefix on the exchange and add, and the exchange and add is already exactly what we're going to use here. So for the purpose of this of the concurrent memory allocation, we can get rid of a lot of synchronization overhead, which we would get by using locks and other more complicated structures, by just using this very special feature of weight-free atomic execution, which is available in mainstream processes with this lock prefix on basic instructions. And that's already a kind of a type of special algorithms which are out there, which are called these weight-free algorithms. And That's just a very simple example of where you can apply these types of synchronization means. But there's actually it's quite tricky to come up with weight-free algorithms in general. But there's that's kind of an area where you can still excel by giving weight-free algorithms for certain situations in your software. So that's a kind of a whole area of expertise when you want to specialize your software skills. So weight-free algorithms are a nice thing, and you can find papers on a lot of aspects of machine behavior that offer this property weight-free implementation. So there's also the idea to abstract a little bit away from that special thing, and always writing that you have to use this log prefix by introducing a new kind of means, like, for example, this atomic block, which would then go away from the level where you have to manually put the assembly to code in there as inline assembler, and move away to a point where the compiler can try to analyze the piece of code that you have written in your atomic block and try to get it in a way that it can be realized on hardware systems with just this log prefix and some other combination of instruction. And if not, the compiler might decide to circumvent this by just alternatively providing an implementation for this atomic block with some types of locks or something. But this would be a way to abstract away from your from the version we've seen before. So this would semantically mean that this whole block should execute as an atomic execution, and this would, for by a special compiler, would be able to be translated to the corresponding atomic CPU instruction, or maybe either fail or try to do an alternate implementation. So that would make the whole thing into a more general concept, and let's go on with this type of or this way of marking little code fragments as atomic blocks, and go over to weight-free synchronization. And there are quite a lot of several different instruction sequences out there which can be implemented in such a way. However, they're not as expressive as you would like them to be, so there's not much control flow possible, so you cannot do any procedure calls from there, you cannot do any loops. Even the branching is probably quite limited. But there are certain types of instructions out there that can be that can operate in a certain with certain conditions. So, other typical weight-free atomic instructions are, for example, ones that act in a way where they put a certain value in a variable and save the value that the variable had before in your in another place, which would be these two programs. And this is a certain type of mini instructions sequence which we would call modify and test. And these are certain building blocks for larger algorithms. So these are modify and tests. What you do is you write something definitely to a memory location and get back the value that it had before. So that's these two. Then there's others like these, where you do at first do a comparison and keep that comparison as a intermediate result somewhere known, where you can access it later on, and then conditionally perform an update on one of the memory locations. So you, if this the condition above was actually true, only then you would change one of the locations that you've mentioned there. In this case, you would put another value in there. These are the so-called compare and swap operations. So these modify and tests or compare and swaps are kind of abstract concepts of instructions that can be realized in an atomic way, and these are building blocks for certain types of algorithms. You're already in the starting place. Okay. Good. Yeah, so the, yes?
The first two operations can be seen as setting a flag B to 0 or 1 if B not already contains B. What is B?
Yeah, that's the value of the flag B. So, yeah, you can only observe kind of a changed value if it hasn't already been there. So the value of the flag is, well, it's probably a little bit ambiguously described here, but yeah, if you overwrite your memory location with the value that it already had before, you don't see any difference. That's why this if not already contains is actually there.
I would expect in program 4 and 5 to be some kind of if in there because it's described as if.
Yeah.
And always assigned to 0.
Well, it might be that the underlying realization, how this atomic block is implemented in your hardware, does that kind of test, but from the programmer's point of view, you don't see a difference to whether the test is actually performed or not, because if you try to write a value in there which already has been there, that's just the same as if you wouldn't have touched it.
So if it has already been there, you don't do anything?
That's the optimization that the hardware does, or I assume the hardware does. So that's why this is there. I also had to think about that line when I read that there. Okay, so these six things that you have seen there are building blocks that you would use for a certain type of programming or a certain type of algorithms, and these have the special property that these algorithms are built for failure. So you don't expect that your modifications that you do on your hardware always were successful. That's particularly referring to that part, for example. So if a certain condition is not met, so if this condition is not true, then you would not perform a certain action. So that... that lets us go deeper into a certain type of algorithm, which are these lock-free algorithms. These are algorithms that you would use if weight-free implementations are not possible, because you probably have too large transactions to implement. So you will get rid of one of the specific properties that you are after. In this case, you will drop the property that your instructions will always succeed and go over to a lock-free implementation, which won't block your threat, but maybe will fail to achieve their goal. And there's a common usage pattern for these types of lock-free algorithms which use, for example, that compare and swap primitive that we have seen on the slides before. So the typical way to make use of such features of your hardware would be to read an initial value I of a sensitive memory area into a locally kept thing with this K, and take that as input for your computation and do something very complicated on that in your function f, and compute a new value j from that. So you would start computing, and then in the next point you would try to make use of your pattern by using this compare and swap instruction to perform update I to j in case that I is still the value that we have emanated from, which was this k. We have cached k locally somewhere where it's not accessible by someone else. And if I is still the value that we assume it to be, we are free to update I with j. So that would be a typical application of our compare and swap thing. And, well, as we have log-free implementation only, we have property that the computation that we do might actually fail in case that the I is not k anymore. We would not update. So what we would do is we would go back to the beginning and try again. So go to the first step. If I was not k anymore, and try to obtain a new basic input for our computation. So that's a typical way to implement a log-free algorithm. That's something that you might see at points where this is a topic. So this special test, whether I is still k, is in most cases your indicator whether some other thread has already done the computation that you have done in the same time. And yeah, in this case, you need to do something else. With that, you could, for example, realize systems where you try to explore some problem space, for example, emanating from certain basic values, and try to just throw a lot of threads at them and let them just do their computations. And in case that one succeeds in updating your data structure behind, then it can do something new, and all the others that have by chance worked on the same thing can then realize that there has been a change and that their result is outdated, and then can continue with just searching for new work. So that's a typical way of implementing software where you don't need logs, so that there can never be a deadlock somewhere. However, you might waste some time, some computation time, where you just did a redundant computation or something. So that's a general recipe for these log-free algorithms. And that's just a more general way of seeing that concept. There's the idea that you can, if you can have such a compare and swap operation for a certain amount of bytes, you can try to group your condition for your parameters of your computation or whatever you would like to achieve with that into that small space for which you have this compare and swap operation, and read these things atomically, calculate a new value, and then perform the relevant or the particular compare and swap operations for these n bytes to check whether you whether the computed result is valid for the whole thing, and in the same time also setting your new value to that. to your.
You said you mentioned earlier the lock free may fail.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think like that operation can be done?
Then something on your preconditions has changed because your initial state from which you emanated is not present anymore, and in this case you cannot rely on the things that you have computed and have to throw them away and do some alternative strategy like recomputing. Yeah, that's what this is referring to. And one of the typical strategies would be to go back and recompute something meaningful. Okay, so calculating a new value must be repeatable, so that's something which is desirable for systems where you don't have any side effects when computing your results. Okay, there's limitations for weight and lock-free algorithms, but I think we will do them next time as we already have 10 to 4. And yeah, so keep in mind, take your laptop with you tomorrow, and I will also... put online the most recent version of the tutorial sheet, and also prepare the virtual machine for you to download before we do our tutorial tomorrow. So thank you for your attention and goodbye.